This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
In the latest of the Legarten Institute's History of Capitalism lectures, we're delighted to welcome Andrew Roberts, something of a man of the hour after the recent publication of his brilliant biography of Napoleon. But here, Andrew is coming to talk to us this evening about Winston Churchill and the relationship between Winston Churchill's life and times and the cause of free trade, something integral to the evolution of the Churchillian career, according to Andrew. Had Churchill, Andrew, always been something of a free marketeer and free trader?
He started off believing in his father's version of Young England, which was a liberal Tory concept. He then became a liberal and quite a radical liberal. He believed in free trade. In fact, that was the reason that he left the Tory party. But he then actually was one of the founders of the welfare state, and only much later on in his career did he rediscover the genius of capitalism.
And in the background, there's another titanic figure. There's Joseph Chamberlain, isn't there? The man whom Churchill himself described as, you know, the politician we were all watching, the guy who made the weather. What's the relevance of the relationship between these two titans of the age?
Well, Joseph Chamberlain was, as you say, a giant. He was also a great personal friend of Lord Randolph Churchill, Winston's father. And so, although they disagreed with one another on the concept of imperial preference versus free trade, nonetheless, Winston Churchill always looked up to Joe, and how could you not, considering that he was a colossus who managed to smash two political parties in his time.
And then this transition, of course, between liberal, Tory, and the nature of that Churchillian political evolution, nonetheless, you see this attachment to the economics of free trade as really fundamentally context to the career.
Yes, Churchill believed, and I think in this he's right, that he didn't move, but the parties moved around him. And you know, that is the case. The 1906 general election was lost by the Conservatives and the Liberal Unionists because they wanted to go down the protectionist route, which would lead to more expensive food for the working man, and therefore were annihilated by the Liberals. And of course, Churchill was a Liberal by that stage. So he had the chance of getting into the cabinet, as well as the chance of being right, in his view, and so he didn't find it difficult to ditch the Tory party. But when he came back to the Tory party, they had themselves embraced free trade. So it was a sort of homecoming for him. And although it was in those days a really radical thing, as it is today, in fact, to cross the floor of the House, let alone to do it twice, it was something that he could see ideologically was actually consistent with his principles. However, to differentiate between free trade and free enterprise, actually, he was in favour of nationalisation of the railways, for example, in 1919, which by 1946 he very much wanted to go back into private ownership. So there you do see a very long evolution of an appreciation by Churchill of the virtues of the free market.
And in reacting against the idea of protectionism, that's that strange big cause of the late 19th century that seemed to appeal to nascent great powers like the Germany of Bismarck and the United States, what was it about protectionism that appealed to so many politicians at that time?
Well, protectionism, I think, is a pejorative term for imperial preference, really. I mean, it was you were preferring other nations of your own kith and kin because, of course, the countries that they wanted to prefer were New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the other English-speaking peoples. And so they felt that these were all very important. Unionism was important to them as well in terms of the Irish politics. In fact, Joseph Chamberlain, of course, split the Liberal Party in order to try to keep Ireland as part of the Great Britain. And so when they had this concept of the great countries that you were talking about, Germany and America, the two other most powerful nations in the world, Britons felt at that time that the only way that they would be able to stand up to that is if the empire, the British Empire, became a single political unit. And the way to do that was to make sure that it was an economic unit.
So imperial preference being a way of not just keeping the imperial show on the road, but of guaranteeing ever further deepening of the economic unity of the empire.
I think that phrase, we've heard it before and we are hearing it quite a lot at the moment, of course, with the Prime Minister's attempted renegotiation of the European deal that Britain has, and his particular attempt to get rid of that phrase. But for somebody who believed in the British Empire as a progressive force for good in the world in about 1900, which, by the way, Winston Churchill did as well. But for Joseph Chamberlain, it became, when he became colonial secretary in 1895, the driving force of his life. He thought that the way in which Britain could recreate a kind of Roman Empire that would bring peace and prosperity for hundreds of years. Today this sounds like an absurd chimera, but back in 1900, if you go back to that late 19th century period under the premiership of Lord Salisbury, it was a genuine concept and something that a lot of people did believe in. The only drawback was that, of course, it did lead to dear food.
And it's a striking fact that when one considers the Churchillian career in its entire magnificence, it's the strength of the opposition to socialism that is really profoundly felt leitmotif throughout that career, isn't it? I mean, radical reformer, yes, political reformer, unemployment exchanges for the unemployed, part of the great liberal radical reforming programme of 1906, the cabinet of which Churchill himself said this was the most talented cabinet of which he'd always ever been a member. He's very proud of that fact. But anti-socialism, through and through.
Yes, it's virtually the only step that he never took was the one into socialism. I mean, he did come out with, and I'm going to be mentioning quite a few of phrases that that are, you know, surprising from a liberal, even a radical liberal. But collectivism was one stage too far, and he really did feel all the way through his life, and especially, of course, in the 1945 general election, in which he denounced all forms of socialism, that it was a foreign import. One that had no part of the warp and woof of the British people, and that it was also didn't work. That was another point. The sheer, you know, efficacy of collectivism, as far as he saw it, was non-existent. So his struggle against socialism was one of the guiding lights of his entire political career, from his first speech when he was a very young man, all the way through to the end.
Socialism being a form of oppressive state and governmental power.
It was not as oppressive as he made it out to be in 1945. He'd read Hayek's Road to Serfdom. He very much felt that this was going to happen. He'd seen what was happening in Europe and, of course, in Eastern Europe after Stalin's invasion of Eastern Europe, effectively, in 1945. He was the first person to warn against this in 1946 in the Fulton speech in Missouri. And he was oppressed with the fear that the state was also going to take over here in Britain. And you see these in his post-1945 speeches, which become much more ideological than really any that he'd made up until then. And although you're right, of course, in saying that Churchill thought that it was that Asquith's cabinet, Campbell Bannerman's and then Asquith's cabinet, were the most talented, and they were. They had all sorts of people in them, from Haldane to David Lloyd George, you know, Bright and everybody. These are massive, you know, men. But still, it was the same cabinet that took us into the First World War.
Well, as this course now advances chronologically, tiptoes into the early years of the 20th century, we are so very delighted to have your company here, Andrew, as we consider these latest issues in the history of capitalism.
Thank you very much indeed. Great honour to be on the show.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.